From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we look at global perspectives on the nationwide protests here in the U.S. Then we learn about policies that experts say are needed to curb climate change.
Governor Evers' executive order also lays out a goal of 100% clean energy by 2050. And that's really what we're trying to get to right now. I think it's a very doable goal, but we are going to need bold action to get us there.
Plus, we hear some new local music on this month's Milwaukee Music Roundup.
These are all new songs that were created, you know, during the quarantine, and at least one is kind of part of a ongoing quarantine project. So there's, it's not over yet.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. Sometimes in a moment of social unrest, it's hard to look past our own backyard. To keep things in a global perspective, Lake Effect has long called upon Carthage College professor Art Sear. He joins Lake Effect's Julian Haida to discuss the past and present of global protest.
Now, the first thing that I wanted to ask you about has to do with civil disobedience. I think a lot of people look to the United States from the outside as this country built from an anti-monarchical revolution centuries ago already. People might remember even no more than 50 or so years ago, the civil rights movements, the protests that happened all across the country, and they think that America is this bastion of democracy and civil disobedience. But it's been 50 years since we've seen the kind of protest that we've been seeing the last couple weeks, months, and years. So do you think that we've lost something in the last several decades that perhaps other countries still use us as an example of?
The country is built on revolution, as you indicated, and we're a country that changes economically and socially, and in terms of population and lots of other things, in a very constant way compared to other more traditional societies in the world, in my opinion. You'd asked about comparing the 60s to today. In the 1960s, there was a very violent dimension to civil rights protest movements, anti-war protest movements, college campus, very radical, often undefined protest movements. It was also a time when we had an extraordinarily high crime rate from the 1950s into the 1990s. I don't know why we had such high crime rates, an unusual thing for a professor or others on the media to say. There are lots of theories and explanations, and people have views. I myself am not convinced by any single explanation, but the fact is that was a very violent time, including terrible political assassinations that you and I discussed off the air briefly. And that is not the case today. But as for demonstrations in America, no, I think they're very American.
That's very interesting, considering how certain political discourses in the United States today seem to have a sense of nostalgia, no matter what kind of one's ideological position is, but a nostalgia for the 60s, whether you're a black protester imagining one's kind of alliance with, you know, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., or perhaps if you are someone more sympathetic towards a kind of a white suburban, affluent kind of lifestyle, invoking the 1960s as this time of kind of respectable safety. So what does that kind of ideological rereading of history imply for today? Is it just kind of foolish, or like how do you see people who try to apply history to today in such a kind of heavy-handed manner?
Well, we all have bias in how we view the world, and it's important to be aware of that, no matter who you are. In American history, we tend to distill the truth eventually. The fact that Dr. King is so durable is very reassuring to me. I think he's quite rightly respected, revered, and the subject of statues that honor him. And that was not the way it seemed to be at the time. Likewise, Abraham Lincoln. So we have our own reading of history, but eventually there is a consensus that, from my point of view, goes in the right direction in America.
Well, that's very interesting in the sense that, I mean, I've spent the last couple of years reading a great deal of Dr. Martin Luther King's speeches, and you're right. I mean, there's a federal holiday. Children have to learn about him in school. There are monuments and statues. And yet sometimes the takeaway is I have a dream, or we can live in peace and harmony. But some of the content of his speeches were angry. He felt dejected. He was depressed. He came out later in life against the Vietnam War and talked about corporations shifting profit overseas. Now, that kind of complicates our understanding of him. So do you think that we can often use that kind of retrospect in a manner that sanitizes people, even as kind of saintly as they may have been?
Yeah, no, Martin Luther King was no saint. And I think the most effective leaders in terms that you and I and we in this country, in terms of the values and goals that we collectively respect and seek, people who are morally upright and have no shortcomings whatsoever tend not to do that well in the political arena. Another man with brief statements, unlike me, for instance, Abraham Lincoln, mentioned more than once that in his career, the people he'd encountered who had absolutely no vices whatsoever didn't seem to have many virtues either. I think Dr. King personifies the human experience in the best sense, when he was at his best. I hope that's clear. You're raising a really, to me, profound point.
Well, thank you for entertaining it. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM 89.7, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Julian Haida, and with me is Arthur Sear. He is the director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College and author of After the Cold War. Now, I wanted to get a little bit into that kind of post-Cold War politics and to see how it might relate to some of what we've been talking earlier. We think about the Cold War, great power politics being over, but Russia and increasingly China are kind of increasing their spheres of influence. And within what they perceive to be their spheres of influence, there have also been massive protest movements. Some have protested the role of police powers, extradition powers in the case of Hong Kong. How does their approach to fighting Russia or China in the name of these principles differ from ours within our own country when, for example, there's an anti-police brutality protest?
That's a very good question. And to give you a pointed response, more pointed than I've been giving, the basic commitment to human freedom, to basic equality under the law, understood as the kind of law that we accept in the US, in Great Britain, in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, most of Europe, especially the Western part. That kind of rule of law is becoming, since the Cold War, increasingly widespread and pervasive. There are cultural differences, to be sure, but people in Hong Kong and Taiwan now has a representative political system, a representative government with party alternation. And what's going on elsewhere in the world, that represents a movement in our direction.
Well, and goodness knows the events of the 20th century, even the ways, I don't know, reparations from World War II were structured directly influences everything we understand about money today. I mean, like, it's hard to underestimate the effects that the mid-20th century had on everything in our lives today.
After the Great Revolution engineered by Deng Xiaoping, people's socialism from the late 70s, but especially the early 90s, the Chinese were most anxious to join the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and the other economic arms of the UN. They were already, of course, part of the General Assembly and the Security Council. The Americans and our allies and other friendly governments were very effective during the first Bush and Clinton administrations in ensuring that they came in, but that Taiwan did too, as a semi-separate entity. The end of the Cold War and rigid ideological confrontations and the end of communism, in effect, has meant that the door is open for negotiation, pragmatism, the kind of traditional diplomacy at which our British friends have excelled. They ran the world in real terms for more or less 200 years, and which Americans are increasingly good at, in my view. Again, the world is moving in our direction, and there's much more openness for our kind of law and reasonable diplomacy.
It's interesting that you mention kind of the British style of diplomacy, and we're talking just a moment ago about the legacy of the 20th century, and I'm wondering how much the legacy of the 21st century, the early 21st century, will be a kind of taking back that legacy. I mean, I think of Brexit, which was not a shining moment for British diplomacy. Meanwhile, the United States' relationship with the United Nations is crumbling, despite the UN being headquartered here. There's a kind of rising nationalism, whether it be in the UK, in the US, or even Russia and China, that makes it difficult to kind of stand on principle and makes it easy to just choose a country that's on your side.
The British have never been comfortable economically in Europe in terms of limiting institutional commitments. At the same time, they have been committed historically, I mean for hundreds of years, to playing an influential and powerful role militarily and diplomatically again in Europe. They orchestrated the broad international coalition that defeated Napoleon. They put in place a concert of Europe that more or less kept the peace for a century till the First World War. They were instrumental in bringing the US into both world wars, especially before the First World War. The Germans were extremely aggressive and to some extent successful, especially in Mexico, and could have turned American public opinion the other way. The British were instrumental in getting the US and Canada into NATO at the end of the 40s. They're among our closest allies in military terms. They were the only real ally that we had in our war in Iraq, launched by the second Bush administration. And they remain firmly committed to NATO. The president complains and criticizes a lot of people in a lot of countries, of course, but he keeps bringing up the fact that our allies have to do more for the alliance. Well, in point of fact, the British are one of very few countries, others being mostly smaller countries in South and Eastern Europe, who've lived up to their NATO obligations, rain or shine, long term. Some of the best soldiers I've ever met, I don't want to personalize this, but I did spend some time in the US Army a long time ago, the Australians, and a few British officers as well, they have an extraordinarily effective military tradition. They're not as numerous as some other armies, but it's really good they're on our side. And I would keep this in mind, given all the hand-wringing and alarm, including in Britain, about Brexit, shorthand for leaving the European Union.
Well, I'd love to keep chatting about this, but we're out of time. Professor Sear, thanks so much for joining us here on Lake Effect again.
Thank you so much.
Art Sear is director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College and author of After the Cold War. He spoke with Lake Effect's Julian Haida. Coming up, our climate conversation series wraps up with a look to the future. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. Each month, WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz speaks with distinguished professor of atmospheric science Paul Rober as part of our Climate Conversation series. In this final installment of the series, they're joined by two policy experts. Amber Meyer-Smith is from the organization Clean Wisconsin, and she's a member of Governor Tony Evers' Climate Change Task Force. Shalonda Baker is a professor at Northeastern University School of Law in Boston. Before moving to Boston, Baker was a Hasty Fellow at UW-Madison. They join Bentz and Rober to discuss what needs to happen to get policy in place to curb climate change.
So, Shalonda, one thing that we've seen already with the pandemic and with past weather disasters like Hurricanes Maria and Katrina, we know, as you pointed out, that climate change is going to have a disproportionate effect on vulnerable populations. That's both here in the U.S. and globally. Despite this, it's also true that just as with the pandemic, climate change ultimately affects everyone. And so it's not like anyone gets a free pass from any of this. And so this really should be seen as a problem for everyone to address, never mind your views on social or racial equity or just fairness in general. So how do you see that dynamic playing out in the policy realm? How do you convince people that this is something that everyone needs to care about?
You know, that is a really hard question. I think there is the moral argument, and that doesn't always carry the day. I think, you know, the backup argument is, well, our fates are inextricably intertwined. And we see that with COVID-19, right? Where we have certain folks who are on the front lines because they have to be, and they're so-called essential workers, but yet they've been expendable up until now. And so I think making the case that our fates are intertwined and that we are connected and that there is no separation between my fate and yours, and there's no separation between my suffering and yours, right? I think that's one way to do it. I also think, you know, economically involving, there's an economic argument, right? Because that's ultimately where we usually end up with these sorts of things. I think there's a case to be made that if we have a strong base and we have folks who are, you know, able to quote unquote bounce back after a major weather event or climate event, that makes us all better. That makes us all stronger, right? It's not as much of a drag on the overall economy. So for me, the moral argument is the first one that I make. The second is, you know, our fates being linked. And we're seeing that in so many ways today with COVID-19. And then I think the third is, you know, there really isn't a case for saying if all boats are lifted, then we're all, you know, we're all better off in terms of the economic picture.
So Amber, you're the Vice President of Programs and Government Relations with Clean Wisconsin. One of the things you're tackling is being part of the Governor's Task Force on Climate, or Climate Task Force. There's a lot to that, but I've been watching some of those meetings, and the points that Shalonda is making have become more and more pronounced in your proceedings, haven't they? It's been a really fascinating journey just to watch from the outside. So can you tell us where things stand basically with the task force and what the potential is, what could be achieved with these recommendations?
Last fall, Governor Evers actually issued an executive order, and he said, climate change matters to me as a governor, and it matters to our state for all the reasons that Shalonda articulated. We need to have a focus, and we need to bring people together to discuss what kind of solutions the state should be looking at. And I want to highlight too that that was coming off of 8 years under Governor Walker, where he had climate change information scrubbed off of the DNR's website. He was not allowing state government to talk about climate change at all. We just have a real hole here in terms of where Wisconsin's at in trying to tackle climate change. So Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes chairs the task force, and I just appreciate so much his leadership in continuing to make sure that we are looking at how inclusive we're trying to be when we're soliciting ideas and solutions. Oh, and I should add that you can also submit your comments. Those are things that the task force will be taking a look at. So once we've done that, heard from the public, heard from community groups, heard from all the voices that really need to be part of this conversation. Our task is to come up with recommendations as a task force that we will ultimately submit to the governor. And COVID-19 has delayed that a little bit. We're looking at the end of October to deliver those recommendations to the governor.
Amber, thanks for that. So my question is a hard one. It's fundamentally about priorities. And so just a little background information. So we know scientists have been warning the world about climate change for about 3 decades. And at least for the last 20 to 25 years, we've understood the parameters of the problem pretty well. Scientifically, we understand that. Since that time, I'd say most of the work has really been about just getting some of the local and regional details understood better, which certainly would be of greatest help to policymakers, but the big picture has been understood. One of the issue of priorities is that just as with a pandemic, delayed action makes the problem much, much worse because of the exponential growth process. So we know, for example, that even though this year greenhouse gas emissions because of the economic shutdown have fallen dramatically, our overall greenhouse gas concentrations are at their highest level in the last 3 to 5 million years. So it's not something that you can do just overnight. It takes concrete action over a long period of time. And unfortunately, unlike the pandemic, in which a timescale of basically 2 to 4 weeks seems to be too long for a lot of people, we're dealing with something that you're talking about having to undertake actions that are effective over many years. So the question is, how do you make effective policy changes in this environment? And for instance, what are the areas of common ground between political parties? You noted what happened under the Walker administration. Now we're seeing a big change, at least from a principled standpoint under the Evers administration, but how does that translate to action where you really need to get everybody on board?
So it's easy to sit down and talk about areas of common ground because there's lots of things that we need to do. But as somebody who sees the science and sees the long-term implications here, we know that the change that we need has to be bold. So it's really, I think, a challenge to kind of bridge that gap between what I might call like more the low-hanging fruit things that we honestly should have been doing 10 years ago that are probably more easy to get consensus on, and the bold action that we really need to make sure that we're protecting ourselves and our health. So I think that's playing out a lot through especially the public comments, which really people are coming at this and they understand the gravity. They're saying, me and my neighbors all have asthma. That can't be right. There's a environmental reason for that. And a lot of it has to do with air pollution and the impacts of things like climate change. Or I can't drink my water. There's just so many impacts that people are seeing there. People have talked about this internal anxiety that they're feeling. I hear this especially from younger generations that are really speaking up. They are concerned for their generation as to the world that they're going to inherit, so much so that it's causing them anxiety. I mean, can you imagine? I can imagine that because I deal with this every day, but it just makes me so sad that these young people have to spend so much time being worried about this when really we should have been doing this a long time ago. Governor Evers' executive order also lays out a goal of 100% clean energy by 2050. And that's really what we're trying to get to right now. I think it's a very doable goal, but we are going to need bold action to get us there and to get to where the scientists warn we're gonna start seeing more the major impacts of climate change.
Shalonda, did you want to jump in?
I was nodding vigorously to both of you, but I want to pick up on the piece that that Paul raised, which is one that I hear a lot, and that is we have no time to lose, right? And how do we balance all of these competing interests? How do we balance a just process against the urgency in which we need to move to avert catastrophic climate change. So I know Paul is a scientist, and he's probably aware that there's already enough carbon dioxide in the atmosphere such that we're going to experience pretty devastating climate impacts, even if we stopped emitting tomorrow, right? So, the question of adaptation is kind of already becoming the one that we need to be dealing with. And I think we can do this transition, you know, in these two tracks, right? We can certainly bring more clean energy online, but as we do so, we need to be making the energy system itself more resilient. But we need an energy system that is itself nimble. And that may mean that the traditional players in the system go away or change roles. And so Amber, one of the things you mentioned was utilities and thinking about utility structure and whether or not we should be kind of relying on traditional investor-owned utilities in the same way, or they change roles and maybe are purely running the electricity through the lines, but all of our communities are kind of putting our energy in that system. And so in order to transition to that kind of new world, we do need courage and ambition, but we also, as you said, need some of that technology to facilitate new markets and new pathways for participation. But this new energy system has to be more nimble. And again, we have to do it in a way that doesn't leave the poorest people, the most marginalized, without access to medicines because they can't keep their houses, you know, cool. They can't keep the refrigerator on in a power outage. And we know that places like California are going to see that a lot more. We can't have folks going out to their rooftops like they did with Hurricane Katrina. And then this massive internal migration because of climate change. We have to figure out ways to make their communities resilient so that they can stay in place when the inevitable storms come, because they are coming, and the fires and the floods. I know it's dark, but we kind of have to face the reality that we're already down a pretty dark path.
If I could jump in there, Shalanda, so some of the comments you made kind of inspired me to get your reaction to this. And to my mind as a scientist, it's a pretty terrifying idea, just to give you that perspective. That's how I feel about it. But because scientists have been watching relative inaction over many years, there are quite a number now that are advocating for geoengineering approaches to combating climate change. And so, in a sense, they've given up on policy as being an effective solution in the short term, at least. And they view geoengineering as a way of buying time for us to get around to the fact of making these changes. So what's your perspective on that?
There's a word called hubris. I mean, we're in effect living through a massively geoengineered time, right? I mean, spewing fossil fuels or carbon dioxide into the atmosphere for the last couple hundred years plus is itself a huge geoengineering experiment, and we failed, right? I mean, I would have faith, well, I don't have faith in geoengineering. Let me just be very transparent, but there are a few reasons why I don't. And one is, if the very same players and power systems, power structures, and I'm talking about political power now and economic power, if they are the ones designing the geoengineering system, then it will certainly be designed to marginalize those who are already on the edge. And so I mentioned first and worst impacted. We have that sort of first and worst. We have those communities here in the United States, but we also have them globally. And in the global South, developing countries will most certainly be on the short end of that stick, because they will likely not be at the design table as those geoengineering experiments get underway. So that's one sort of moral and ethical concern I have with geoengineering. And then other is, I just don't trust that we know enough about the atmosphere and the complexity of our Earth systems to make it work. We can't even,
Let me just say I heartily second that.
Okay, yeah, I'm the lawyer. And then I don't know how you would govern it. I mean, we have an international system that is defunct, dysfunctional. Our president pulls out of agreements left and right, and we barely sign agreements here in this country. So we would need a system of international governance to manage geoengineering, and we don't have a good example of what that would look like. So for all those reasons, the moral, the science, and just lack of governance, I would say no.
You know, this gets to the heart of the part of the complexity, right? I mean, how do we get at those big, big, powerful forces that have guided our economies and our nations for so long? We're sort of at that point. Action is critical.
I really think that where all of that starts is by people, by trying to lift people's voices and by having them be part of the conversation. You know, we have had these unfortunately polarized and partisan conversations in Wisconsin for far too long around climate change and energy. I think that when you start looking at stuff like that, that motivates politicians, say polling being one of those things, you can see a pretty stark difference when you start looking, especially at younger generations and how they feel about climate change and the action that they demand. And so you're going to start having real political problems if you're not, if you're going to keep sticking your head in the sand on climate change. It is not a sustainable position to say no. And I'm glad that we've moved away from that. So I think like a combination of people being more vocal. I mean, think about these wonderful youth movements in climate that we have seen just leading the way. It gets conversations started. It gets you seeing the spectrum of opportunity of where we could go, and that's a good thing. So just like getting outside of this partisan box is going to be really necessary. I will say the thing that has come up a lot with the task force lately is, well, we're going to be in, you know, recession, you know, huge economic impacts. We can't do anything that spends money. And I just have to say, I think that's so such short-term thinking. No, for the reasons that I already outlined, these kind of solutions can be part of reinvigorating our economy. They can be job creators. They are huge job creators. Let's start thinking about this in a totally different way about how we transform our workforce and our communities to be part of, to take advantage of the clean energy economy that is here and that other states have really unfortunately been capturing in way more than Wisconsin has. We'll get there, but we do need to start moving fast.
Paul, are you in the mood for a closing comment or an observation? Where has this conversation taken you?
Well, I think it just reinforces in my mind how many opportunities do exist to change this story in a positive way instead of just continuing to drift in the direction that we have been. So there's things that we can do on many different fronts that would help make the future a lot less grim than it looks right now. And I think that's the big takeaway here. But we have to start doing it.
That was Amber Meyer-Smith from Clean Wisconsin. You also heard from Shalonda Baker, a professor of law, public policy, and urban affairs at Northeastern University School of Law, and Paul Rober, distinguished professor of atmospheric science at UW-Milwaukee. They spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Benz. Coming up, Milwaukee Records' Matt Wild joins us to share some of the best new songs from local musicians. That's when Lake Effect returns in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Although most live shows have been put on hold by the pandemic, Milwaukee bands are continuing to release new songs, and Matt Wild has listened to most of them. Wild is one of the co-founders of Milwaukee Record, which describes itself as an online source for music, culture, and gentle sarcasm. Among the many cultural things Milwaukee Record keeps track of is a nearly exhaustive list of new music from local musicians. Wild is the curator of that list, and he joins me every month to share with us a sample of what he's been listening to for our Milwaukee Music Roundup. Matt Wild, thank you so much for joining us once again here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me back. Great to be here.
So again, another list of songs. Some of us are still in quarantine. Some of us not so much. But none of these songs really have to do with the pandemic or the quarantine or the woes of the world.
I think, yes, we've maybe thankfully moved beyond the very specific songs about the quarantine. But these are all new songs that were created, you know, during the quarantine. And at least one is kind of part of a ongoing quarantine project. So there's still a little bit in there. So it's not over yet.
Well, that's for sure. So this first song, I don't actually know this artist, and I think they have such an interesting name.
The first artist we're going to be talking about is Lord Freddy. Freddy, yes, with two threes at the end of Freddy. For my money, I think Lord Freddy is one of the most interesting and fascinating and adventurous and unpredictable Milwaukee artists of the last few years. He's been putting out incredible albums at least for 4 or 5 years now. He had an album in 2016 called Dead Man's View. It was one of the very best Milwaukee albums of that year. In 2018, he put out another record called North, The Legend of Hot Boy Ronald. And that was an incredible, incredible album. Got a lot of national press as well. And ever since then, he's been just putting out a couple songs here and there, a couple tracks here and there. And the thing about Lord Freddy is you never know what you're going to get with him. You never know what you're going to get from album to album. You never know what you're going to get from song to song. And sometimes even within a single song, you don't know what's going to happen from minute to minute. He's just all over the map creatively, and I think he's a endlessly fascinating artist. You know, it's so incredible watching an artist kind of reinvent himself every 5 minutes, it seems. And so kind of keeping with that spirit of reinvention and adventure, he has a new track out. It is called Jumper, and it is unlike anything he's ever really done before. It starts out as kind of this kind of slow spiritual song with a lot of voices in the background, and suddenly it explodes into this kind of crazy, almost kind of 90s techno kind of sound that reminds me of like an old Prodigy song or something. It's just crazy, and it's just this burst of energy and this burst of creativity, and he calls it righteous riot music, which I really like that term, and I really like this track as well. So it's very on point for Lord Freddy to be doing something this out of left field suddenly, and this song in particular I think is a perfect song for him, and it's a perfect song for the times we're living in and everything going on. So it's righteous riot music. It is Lord Freddy with Jumper. Jumper by Lord Freddy. So kind of in keeping with the title of that song, jumping to the next track, Brief Candles Dimmer. This is a very different vibe than the first song. Yes, this installment we will be shifting gears very, very quickly and going from one thing to the other. There's no real theme holding a lot of these songs together, but other than the fact that they're great Milwaukee tracks. So yes, this is Brief Candles with a song called Dimmer. Now, Brief Candles, they are one of those groups that at least for myself, and I think for a lot of people, unfortunately, it's a group I can kind of take for granted sometimes. They've been around at this point for almost 20 years or something like that. They are originally from Peoria, Illinois. They moved here in the early aughts, and they've just been kind of this stalwart band that has been playing in Milwaukee for close to 2 decades now. It's fronted by a husband and wife team, Jennifer and Kevin Dixon, and they do what they do, and they do it really, really well. And that is basically this very dreamy, very shoegazy sound, reminiscent of, you know, the big bands of that kind of genre, groups like the Jesus and Mary Chain or Sonic Youth. They're just one of those bands, like I said, they're so easy to take for granted, and they shouldn't be taken for granted because they're so, so good at what they do. And they put out dozens of albums and EPs and singles over the years. And their latest is called Dimmer. It's been just released. It's from an upcoming album. Both Kevin and Jennifer kind of trade off on vocals. So really looking forward to this album whenever it's released. The track we'll be listening to is called Dimmer.
Was Dimmer by Brief Candles. So again, we're switching to a very different genre now. What I found interesting is I was listening to this song and it automatically played something next. And the song that it played next was a Drake tune. And I went, oh, interesting. It's a song that I think speaks to, in some ways, kind of popular music.
Absolutely, yeah. The algorithms are working apparently here. The artist we'll be listening to next is, his name is Genesis Renji, and this is the artist I was kind of alluding to earlier, kind of making music during the pandemic. Ever since the pandemic began, Genesis Renji has been releasing, I believe, pretty much one song every week, usually on Mondays at the start of the week, and has so far released more than, I don't know, 24 songs or something like this. And they're all really, really great. I really, really enjoy Genesis Renji. There's so many Milwaukee musicians and artists that you could classify as hardworking. You know, they're always putting stuff out. And I don't think any list would be complete if it didn't include Genesis Renji. So he's been putting out new tracks every week since the pandemic began. He's a young guy, still in his 20s, and I just really like his work ethic. I really like his vibe as well. The song we're going to be listening to is called On Your Mark. And it's very much kind of in the vein of all of these songs that he's been putting out during the pandemic. Pretty chilled out, pretty dreamy, and just it's great to see someone like this just continually putting stuff out. He's doing a terrific job, and it's, again, someone to really keep your eye on during this pandemic, and hopefully whenever we get out of it, someone to keep your eye on once we do emerge on the other side. So yes, Genesis Renji with On Your Mark.
Runners on your mark, I be running with a lot. I be running through the dark, so much that you don't see. Know that it's a lot that I carry to the top, and I know I never fly, so I put it on me. Runners on your mark, I be running with a lot. I be running through the dark, so much that you don't see. Know that it's a lot that I carry to the top, and I know I never fly, so I put it on me. Feel the pressure coming, but I never ran from nothing. If you fall for it all, then you stand for nothing. Put my heart in it. Personality's balancing.
to stay while it's fun. Problem is they don't wanna be wrong.
I need a new day. The sun is behind me, the roof getting rocky. I can go two ways. Are you right beside me?
That was On Your Mark from Genesis Renji. So to cap off the four songs that we'll be listening to for this month, this next song, very local, all of the lyrics for the song. And the artist is also a local guy, Pete Freeman.
Pete Freeman, he kind of came to my attention a couple of years ago now. He has kind of this funny story. There was this, I believe it was a Vogue article that came out, and it was one of these articles that's always about, hey, Milwaukee, it's the up-and-coming city. It's not just beers and brats and cheese. They have an art museum, too. Check them out. And like Milwaukee does, anytime a national publication acknowledges our existence, we got all excited about this Vogue article, and everyone's sharing, and everyone got all excited. And Pete Freeman, who was unknown to me at the time, he kind of came out of nowhere and he wrote this song, which was basically telling people, hey, if you read that Vogue article, don't come here. It's actually a terrible place to live. It's cold. It's miserable. Move to Chicago instead. Just leave us alone. Don't come here. And it was this very funny, very, you know, kind of tongue-in-cheek song, like, please leave us alone. We got our own good thing going here. And he's kind of followed that up with a lot of similar, very local flavored songs. He wrote a song for Milwaukee Brewers superfan Front Row Amy, which was a big hit, and I believe she herself heard the song and enjoyed it as well. And since then, he's put out, I think one of his albums was called Wisconsin Stories, which kind of gives you an indication of what he's writing about. And it's very pared down, very kind of acoustic folk music, and just kind of shot through with this really funny sense of humor, this little bittersweet sense of humor as well. And, you know, it's his tongue is always kind of in his cheek a little bit, but I think he's a terrific musician and a terrific lyricist. He has a new album that just came out. It's called Meat and Potatoes. And the song we're going to be listening to is a highlight, one of my favorites from that record. It's called Milwaukee River. And in keeping with this kind of tongue-in-cheek, self-deprecating tone, it's about how the Milwaukee River is super dirty and gross, and he's fishing in it, and he's catching, like, old car parts. And then at the end, a pedal tavern goes by, falls into the river, and is eaten by a river monster. So really covers all the bases for what you want in a song about Milwaukee River. And Pete is such a funny, terrific guy. He's got a big heart. I know recently he was doing a bunch of virtual concerts and raising all this money for local charities, and I think he made quite a bit. So check him out. It's Pete Freeman with this song, Milwaukee River.
Well, I'd never been much of a fisherman, but I went out one day with a few of my friends. We threw out a line, and what did we find on that old Milwaukee River? It was a 10-inch carburetor. Said maybe we could throw that on the grill later. But it was catch and release, so we gave back that beast to the old Milwaukee River. Well, back in the day, they swam and slid and played. If I took a dip right now, I'd probably grow an extra leg. And it don't gotta be cold for you to get a shiver on the old Milwaukee River. Well, the next thing you knew, we were just cruising along, singing the words to our favorite summer song. But the sound was drowned out by a loud and mighty shout on the old Milwaukee River. It was a 21st birthday and a bachelor party, and I do believe they had pedals under their feet. But the sound of the song and screams drowned out my warning on the old Milwaukee River. There was a big, bad, ugly river monster. I wondered if they could pedal faster, but I wasn't sure. So the party met their fate on that sunny summer day on the old Milwaukee River.
That was Milwaukee River from Pete Freeman. Now, Milwaukee Record has actually been doing quite a lot of stuff during the quarantine. What do you guys have on the docket for June?
That's a really good question. We just got finished with an 8-hour virtual summer festival that we put together because obviously there are no summer festivals or little to no summer festivals this year. So it was our first and hopefully last virtual summer festival where we featured a ton of local music, including Pete Freeman and Brief Candles. They debuted a couple videos and performances on that live stream. So you can still find that entire 8-hour live stream on our website. As for June, I think it's so hard these days that you kind of roll with the punches. And now that we're out of this haze of putting together this big live stream, I'm looking forward to kind of just like getting back to work, kind of covering everything we can cover, whether it's pandemic related or protest related. And that's, yeah, just been kind of the way we've been operating. And I know so many other people have been operating for the last few months, just kind of rolling with the punches and doing the best we can. So that's what we'll be doing. Like I said, I'm looking forward to kind of getting back to work and covering everything that's going on, music and non-music related, in Milwaukee.
All righty. Well, Matt Wild, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work as always.
Thanks for having me.
Matt Wild is the co-founder of Milwaukee Record. Every month, he publishes his Milwaukee Music Roundup and joins us to talk about a few of those songs. You can find our previous conversations with Wild at WUWM.com. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for tuning in today. Please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.